Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the First Western Trust Bank Engineering Your Retirement Withdrawals conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded today, Thursday, November 3rd, 2011. I would now like to turn the conference over to Warren Olson, Chief Investment Officer. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks, Colin. Hi, it's Warren Olson. I think I know most of you on the call, but for those of you I don't know, you know, I'm the one of the co-founders of First Western, and I'm the chairman and CEO of our investment management businesses. The call today is one of a series of calls that, you know, we do on a periodic basis to help clients and their advisors with their financial lives. You know, from the beginning of our existence at First Western, we believe that, you know, to provide really superior financial advice to our clients, we need to take a, you know, holistic, connected view of their financial lives. And, you know, I believe this webinar presents another aspect of how we do this. Before I introduce Dave Cerullo, who's going to present on today's topic, I did want to speak to you briefly about kind of investing during your retirement years. I mean, investing for retirement is difficult, but I think investing during your retirement has actually probably never been more difficult for retirees, and I think there's really four basic reasons for that. The first reason is actually a very good reason, and that's, you know, we're all living longer. So if you retire at a sort of standard age of 65, the actuarial tables tell you that if you're, you know, a female, you're going to live 20 years, if you're male, you're going to live 17 years. But as my father likes to say, my father's 93, the longer you live, the longer you're going to live. So theoretically, you're never actuarially dead. So at 85, actuarially, you're going to live another 6 to 7 years again, depending on your sex. And so the concept that a retiree can take a short-term view of investing is simply not true. This is really important, too, because if you think about investing over a 20 to 25-year period and you assume a 5% annual inflation rate, which is above the sort of stated historical rate of 3 and 3.5%, you know, which is the CPI, but actually probably closer to your real inflation rate because certain expenses tend to inflate at a higher rate, things like healthcare costs, energy, lately food. There was an article about, you know, the price of meat inflating pretty rapidly over the last year. Your expenses, again, over that period of time will actually triple. The second reason it's a difficult period for retirees to invest is that we're in an unusually low interest rate environment. That tends to hurt retirees disproportionately. If you think about it, retirees are lenders and not borrowers. You know, they buy bonds. And for most retirees, the concept of, you know, parking your money in safe U.S. government bonds and living off the interest really just doesn't work anymore. You know, the third reason it's tough is, you know, we just have very complex, volatile, and correlated financial markets, probably more so than any time in history. So, you know, for those of you who looked at the stock market today, you'll see that it closed about, you know, 2% higher, and it was really driven by three big stories, you know, primarily the Greek situation and, you know, the fact that the Greek prime minister, if he still is the prime minister as I'm speaking, you know, backed down on this idea of a national referendum on the EU debt solution. But also, you know, there was this kind of feeling that the effect on the global supply chain of all this flooding in Bangkok, Thailand is lessening a little bit. And then the third thing you saw was this, you know, the bankruptcy filing of a company called MF Global, which is a company that's a primary dealer in complex derivative instruments. So, you know, these three very disparate things, the fact that people felt like at the margin they were all kind of improving, you know, caused a, you know, that's a 2% is a very big jump if you think about the overall value of the stock market. And so this market volatility, both up and down, is, you know, it's extremely difficult, especially emotionally for investors, especially for those retirees who don't have another source of income. It also challenges the notion of traditional diversification of just owning stocks and bonds. I think retirees have to look at the world of investing in a little broader. And then the fourth and finally, which is really the topic of today's call, it's very difficult for retirees to invest because the rules governing, you know, retirement funding vehicles, the stuff that Dave's going to talk about today, such as IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401ks, and the like, and then their interplay with income state, with income tax and estate tax laws is very complex. So, you know, if you're a retiree, then, what are you supposed to do? And you know, for our mind, there's really two major topics that you need to really take care of. One is, retirees need a strategic asset allocation plan, and they need to take into account, you know, the need that they have to be protected from permanent loss of capital. At that stage of your life, that's very difficult to overcome. But it also has to provide the required liquidity. Most retirees don't have another source of liquidity other than their investment portfolio. And then the third thing, and I already talked about it in inflation, is it needs to protect against erosion of purchasing power due to inflation. These are actually kind of competing goals if you think about it. So that, you know, the trick is to build an individualized portfolio that takes into account those needs and the amount of money and the variety of other things that an individual has. And those are the things that our portfolio managers work with on clients. And then the third, the other thing really is to use all these complex laws and rules governing, you know, retirement vehicles and the placement of assets to their advantage and not to their disadvantage. And that's really where David comes in. And so, you know, with that, I'm going to turn this over to Dave Cerullo. Dave's a wealth planning advisor here at First Western. He's joined us after a really good career in public accounting, most recently from a prominent regional accounting firm, and then previously he worked in the tax department of a Big Four international accounting firm. He's got undergraduate and graduate degrees in accounting and tax. Dave's a certified public accountant. And he's an active member of both the American and Colorado Society of CPAs and a member of the Denver Estate Planning Council. So with that, David.
Thank you, Warren, and good afternoon, everybody. As Warren mentioned, today I'm going to discuss engineering retirement withdrawals for clients and some possible strategies to consider. I think the most important takeaway from today's presentation is a need for all of our clients' advisors to work together implementing planning. Specifically, it is key for estate attorneys, investment advisors, and CPAs to communicate and review the client's retirement plan on a regular basis. Before I get into the details of the presentations, I would just like to share a cartoon related to retirement. For those that's listening and can't see the slides, the title is basically Morning Coffee, and it's two individuals discussing retirement plans. One of the individuals says, I finally put something aside for my retirement. I put aside my plans to retire. We're going to discuss seven pieces when considering retirement withdrawals. In order to have a complete retirement plan, the pieces must be put together and each considered with one another. You will also notice many of the pieces will overlap in our discussion. When reviewing retirement withdrawals, the most common factors considered are typically income tax, taxable accounts, tax-deferred accounts, and other income sources. Some of the factors often overlooked in retirement planning are investment asset location, as Warren mentioned a little bit earlier, estate tax considerations, and review of existing trusts. Why is this presentation important to your clients? I've listed just a few of the benefits of a proper retirement plan. I'm not going to read the entire slide here, but I did want to highlight the benefits of a properly planned retirement withdrawal strategy. Focusing on the left side of the slide, what are some of the benefits of a proper plan? Of course, one of the most obvious is maximize your income tax savings. Another item is efficiently give to charitable organizations, one that's many times overlooked. One that's become increasingly popular, especially with Roth IRAs, is the extending of your tax-deferred accounts, not only over your lifetimes, but the lifetime of your heirs. One of the ones that CPAs may be most interested in is potentially eliminate complicated K-1 tax filings from personal 1040s. That comes into play with hedge funds, and we'll look at that a little bit later. Maximize estate basis step-up. The next is to use trust loss to your advantage, specifically five states that I'll mention a little bit later in the presentation. And the last I have here is to maximize your annuity payments. I'm going to use a case study of a hypothetical high net worth family to demonstrate the retirement withdrawal planning strategies related to these seven factors. First, let's start with the net worth assumptions. I have a client, hypothetical client family here, John and Jane Brown, age 71 and 65, both with kids outside, grown up, and married. The net worth of the Browns is $15 million, consisting of taxable accounts, traditional IRAs, Roth IRAs, annuities, and real estate. The cost basis of these assets is also listed, total cost basis being $9.1 million. So there's a built-in unrealized gain of these assets of about $5.9 million. Now let's just quickly look at the income and expense numbers. I've included 2010 just as reference, but I want to focus on the 2011 projected adjusted gross income of $220,000 and projected taxable income of $175,000. A couple other important items from this slide is the annual living expenses assumed to be $350,000 a year, as well as a family trust that was inherited from Jane's parents with a $2 million total value. When researching for today's presentation, most of the articles I read refer to the traditional approach for retirement planning. Basically, this is the approach of taking retirement withdrawals first from your taxable accounts, which is essentially accounts where you've already paid tax on the money. This piece is reflected on this chart in the orange color. As you can see, the piece of the client's portfolio is slowly being depleted over their lifetime and is actually completely gone by the year 2000 or 2031, somewhere in between there. Once the taxable money is used up, the next withdrawals would come from your tax-deferred accounts, with the assumption that you would try to defer accounts as long as possible without paying income taxes. Most typical of these accounts include your traditional and Roth IRAs. The traditional Roth IRA assets are listed in green. I'm sorry, the traditional IRA assets are listed into the green, and the Roth IRA assets are listed in the yellow. As you can see, the noticeable factor in the chart is the high growth of the Roth IRA and really the flat growth of the traditional IRA. The main reason is required minimum distributions, or RMDs. Essentially, traditional IRAs do require distributions over your lifetime once you hit age 70 and a half, but Roth IRAs do not have this. As you will see in today's presentation, taking the traditional approach will not always make sense with your client's individual situation. The larger our client's wealth becomes, the more complicated the decisions. So let's begin with a look at the first piece of the case study. The Browns have three taxable accounts totaling $6 million in fair market value. As you can see, each of these accounts is assumed to have an unrealized gain or loss associated with it, as well as an estimate of annual amount of income. By asking some simple questions, we can determine strategies the Browns can apply to their retirement withdrawals. First question we could ask is, what are some of the annual tax planning opportunities available for taxable accounts? One of the most common tax planning techniques is related to capital gains and losses. It is very common for CPAs and investment advisors to communicate at year-end and discuss tax loss harvesting, which basically means, are there any assets we can sell to minimize the amount of capital gains a client pays in a particular year? It also makes sense to discuss the amount of short-term gain recognized, since this is taxed at ordinary income tax rates. In an ideal world, you would like to pay tax only on long-term investments, and take advantage of the 15% long-term capital gain rate? The second question is, what type of assets should the client hold within their taxable accounts? I'm going to answer this question in more detail later in the presentation, but I did want to spend just a minute going over the types of assets assumed to be generating the annual income in the taxable accounts for the Browns. The first two accounts are assumed to hold domestic and international equities, which typically pay mostly qualified dividend income, which is taxed at 15%. The third account is assumed to be municipal bonds, which are not taxable on the federal level. Third question I have listed here is, should the Browns follow the traditional approach to retirement withdrawals and use their taxable accounts to pay for 100% of their living expenses? If we follow the research and took the traditional approach, the answer would be yes. However, the Browns' net worth of $15 million, there are many other factors to consider before answering this question. In that case, I would like to make the argument that this answer to this question would be no, and we'll see why as we review some of the other planning factors. Income tax will always be a factor in each of these strategies we discussed today. However, I would like to mention just a couple of these strategies in a separate discussion. First, I would like to review the ordinary income tax rates for 2011-2012. Today's presentation will be focusing only on the married filing jointly brackets, since we are assuming the Browns are happily married. The ordinary brackets are set to expire at the end of 2012 and will potentially go back to the highest tax rate of 39.6 in 2013. I've also included three additional taxes to be aware of in retirement planning. On the bottom of the slide here, I have qualified dividends and long-term capital gains, both currently at 15% for 2011-2012. Once they expire at the end of 2012, dividends essentially will all be ordinary and be taxed at ordinary income tax rates. Long-term rates will increase by 5% and potentially go to a 20% rate. And then another new tax to be aware of that begins in 2013 is the Medicare surtax, which is on all portfolio income. You actually don't hit this tax until you have a modified adjusted gross income of greater than $250,000 for married filers. One of the easier ways to help our clients is to use the tax brackets to our advantage. Let's quickly relate the Brown situation to our case study. I've assumed the estimated taxable income for the Browns in 2011 is $175,000. If we flip back to the previous slide, you can see that they would be in the 28% tax bracket. That means they could take in approximately $37,000 of additional income before being kicked into the 33% tax bracket. How I've calculated that is essentially taking the highest tax in the 28% bracket, which is the $212,300, less the $175,000, and that's how I got to the $37,000. We could essentially use this $37,000 as wiggle room to take in additional ordinary taxable income and still pay only a 28% tax rate. The additional income could come from a partial conversion of a traditional IRA to a Roth, or simply by taking an additional distribution from your traditional IRA. Let's look at another tax planning opportunity related to charitable contributions. In the case study, I've assumed the Browns have an annual desire to make $35,000 of charitable contributions, which is a part of their annual living expenses of $350. I have listed the adjusted gross income, or AGI, charitable limitations as a side note. If you recall, the estimated AGI for the Browns was $220,000. The limitations for cash contributions is 50% of AGI, or $110,000 for the Browns, and a 30% limitation on property contributions, or $66,000 for the Browns. Since the Browns give away only $35,000 per year, they're not subject to limitations. However, if you do have a client who falls into these limitations, the contributions carry over for 5 years. More importantly is how your clients make their contributions. Cash works well, but appreciated long-term property works best. Most commonly used in charitable planning are publicly traded stocks. For example, if the Browns donate a stock with a fair market value of $60,000 and a cost basis of 10, they would receive the full $60,000 contribution but never pay capital gains tax on the $50,000 gain. Property must be held for 1 year and a day to qualify for this deduction. And just a side note to be aware of, you should never donate long-term property with a loss as you will lose the benefit. Next, we're going to talk about tax-deferred accounts. I have here a chart of the required minimum distributions, which you probably all have seen. One of the unique factors in this chart, I wouldn't say unique, but one of the different factors that make it a little easier to read is the actual percent of your IRA that's being required to be withdrawn per year once you reach age 70 and a half. So as you can see at age 70, the required amount of your fair market value of your IRA is 3.65 that needs to be distributed. It steadily increases over your lifetime, and then if you compare that to age 85, basically 6.76% of your IRA needs to be distributed under required minimum distributions. So I thought that was a little bit different than seeing just the factors, the 27.4, the 26.5, et cetera. So let's look at the case study for the Browns and their IRA accounts. I've assumed Jane owns one traditional IRA worth $1 million. She's only 65, so no required minimum distributions or RMDs are coming out yet. John, age 71, owns a traditional IRA valued at $500,000 and a Roth IRA valued at $1.5 million. Because John is 71, he's taking RMDs on his traditional IRA. I've calculated the RMD at 71 to be $18,868, which is essentially the $500,000 divided by the RMD factor of 26.5 from the previous slide. One of the biggest advantages of a Roth IRA is they do not require minimum distributions, so over John's lifetime, he'll never be required to take a distribution out of his Roth IRA. So I've listed a few questions to ask your clients in similar situations. First question is, should the Browns consider converting more funds to a Roth IRA? In the case of the Browns, I would say it makes sense to convert more funds to a Roth. The ordinary income, taxable income for the Browns will increase once Jane reaches age 70 and a half. Her traditional IRA is twice as large as John's, being valued at $1 million. Jane's first RMD would increase the Browns' taxable income by approximately $37,000. If you remember, this much additional income would push them into the next tax bracket of 33%. The amount of RMDs will only increase over time, and each year the taxable income will increase and eventually put the Browns in the top tax bracket, which is currently 35% and potentially 39.6% in 2013. The next question here is, do we take distributions from a Roth IRA? Again, in the Browns' case, I would say it would not be necessary. If the Browns do not use their Roth IRA funds for retirement, the potential for tax deferral is tremendous. Not only would the assets be deferred over their lifetimes with no RMDs, the Roth IRA could be left to their children and deferred over their lifetimes. However, the RMDs would be kicked in for an inherited Roth IRA, so you can't pass those from generation to generation by never taking assets out. Third question. If John and Jane are not using their RMDs, are there any options to help the income and estate tax burden? This question comes up occasionally. It's really with clients who are sensitive to paying estate taxes and income taxes. There's actually an interesting strategy to consider using life insurance funded into an irrevocable life insurance trust or an ILIT. Essentially, you would take the RMDs your client is receiving and purchase a permanent type of insurance policy owned by the ILIT. Purpose of this strategy is to give your client additional value from their traditional IRA RMDs by providing an estate tax-free ILIT to their heirs. Very interesting concept that I've recently run the numbers on, works well in particular situations. Final question on here is, what assets should your client hold within their tax-deferred accounts? I'll actually answer this question in our next topic, which will lead us into asset location. The location of a client's investment assets can play a significant role in retirement withdrawal strategies. I've included a pie chart for John and Jane Brown's current asset allocation. The assets classes are typical of what you see with your clients. We have equities, real estate investment trusts or REITs, commodities, high yield, municipal and taxable bonds, and hedge funds being the last class here. So why is asset location important? There are several advantages of holding certain assets in taxable accounts versus tax-deferred accounts. First, let's start with the taxable accounts. Some of the assets that we recommend to be held in your taxable accounts are high-growth assets, essentially assets where we can take advantage of the long-term capital gain rates of 15%. One of the more obvious assets is the municipal bonds, because those are tax-free from federal income tax. It makes sense to hold those outside of your tax-deferred accounts. Any type of dividend-paying stocks, either domestic or foreign, that kick out qualified dividends so we can take advantage, again, of that 15% rate. One other item that's sometimes overlooked is the foreign tax credit. Sometimes foreign stocks will actually have to pay tax to their current or their local jurisdiction, and you actually get a dollar-for-dollar credit of those taxes on your individual 1040 return, so something you don't want to lose there. The next item and final item under taxable accounts are hedge funds. And as you can see, I've actually got those listed on both sides of the slide here, one in taxable, one in tax deferred. This really depends on what type of income those funds are kicking out. There's one item to be aware of called unrelated business taxable income. It's essentially trade or business type of income within tax deferred accounts that would actually be taxable at trust tax rates. And essentially, once you hit $1,000 of that type of income, you actually have to file a separate return for your IRA, which is essentially a 990T. So one thing to be aware of. If you can get away with putting hedge funds that don't kick out that type of income into your tax-deferred accounts, your CPAs will love you, because those hedge funds can be pretty complicated as far as tax filings. The tax-deferred accounts. So why put commodities, REITs, and et cetera in there? Commodities actually have collectible gains associated with certain amounts of funds, specifically metals, so gold, silver, copper, those types of things. They actually have a 28% long-term rate versus a 15% rate. REITs, the biggest disadvantage of a REIT being outside of a tax-deferred account is they actually kick out non-qualified dividends, which is taxed at ordinary income tax rates, or potentially at the highest bracket of 35%. REITs often kick out dividends at year end too, without any type of planning situations to really plan for the additional taxable income that come from those types of funds. The hedge funds we've already discussed. Then the next two, taxable bonds and high yield income, are again pretty obviously, because those are kicking out ordinary interest income, it might make sense to keep those in tax-deferred accounts as well. One other item to consider is the actual rates that you're receiving, though, from these types of bonds. So you have to compare that between munis and taxable bonds just to make sure you're getting the best after-tax rate. So we have three pieces remaining to discuss, and estate tax is the next. You may be asking yourself, why would estate taxes be included in my retirement withdrawal planning strategy? Often it is overlooked, and we should take advantage of some of the current laws. Let's discuss by looking at another case study for the Browns. If you remember, the assumed fair market value of their estate was $15 million. The current exemptions for individuals is $5 million or $10 million for a husband and wife, which is brings you to a taxable estate of $5 million. Right now, for 2011-2012, the current tax rate, estate tax rate, is 35%. which in this case would kick the Browns in of about $1.75 million in tax. So what are some of the questions we should be asking for estate planning? The first question is, what assets should the client hold on to for basis step up? The real estate is the first obvious answer to this question. Since there was about a $1.5 million unrealized gain within the property, that makes sense to hold on to these assets without selling before death, if possible. However, one of the biggest advantages of these estate step up outside real estate would be the assets in your taxable accounts that have low basis. We've already discussed earlier that these assets make good lifetime charitable contributions, and we also discussed minimizing your capital gains under the income tax planning. But if you have the opportunity to hold on to these types of assets with low basis and not use for retirement, then you would be able to take advantage of the step up in basis. The step up basically allows your heirs to take assets at fair market value at the date of death and avoid paying capital gains tax on the unrealized gain. So in the case study here, I've got another chart on the right side that goes through the calculation of the step up and potential savings. So again, the fair market value of the estate is $15 million. The cost was $9.1 million. So there's an unrealized gain of $5.9 million. Annuities, unfortunately, do not receive a stepped up in basis because of the ordinary income tax nature of those assets. So we have to subtract that piece out. So the total assets that qualify for a step up are $5.5 million. The current long-term capital gain rates are 15%, so that's a potential savings of $825,000, would essentially wipe out half of your estate tax bill. So it's a pretty good item to look at and strategy to consider when you're looking at retirement withdrawals. The second question I have here is, what assets should clients consider leaving to charitable organizations? And this is really aimed at, assets they want to leave to charitable organizations in their wills or trusts upon death. So many of the times, charitable benefits of leaving IRAs are overlooked. One of the biggest advantages of using a traditional IRA to meet charitable goals is the avoidance of income tax or a death. It's considered income in respect to the decedent or the IRD. So if the Browns have decided to leave $2 million to various charitable organizations, then it might make sense to use their traditional IRAs. The next couple of questions relate back to the Roth IRAs. Basically, should the Browns take distributions from the Roth IRA, or should they further convert IRAs to Roth IRAs? That's traditional IRAs. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to reinforce the advantages of Roth IRAs as an inherited asset. The Roth IRA would grow tax-free over your client's lifetime with no required minimum distributions. And once those assets are inherited, the Roth would continue to grow tax-free, but the heirs would eventually have to begin taking RMDs based on their life expectancies. The overall tax-free growth between the two lifetimes could be tremendous and is a great planning opportunity if available. Next piece we'll discuss today is trust income. If you recall, we assume Jane inherited assets in a family trust from her parents. The current value of the trust is valued at $2 million and was originally set up under California law. All of the original trust assets were allocated generation skipping transfer GST tax exemption. The trust beneficiaries were John and Jane, and then their children, Jack and Jill. So the first question we should be asking in these situations is, should the Browns take distributions from the trust? I think it is clear in this case study, the Browns do not need additional income. If the Browns were to take distributions from the trust, the assets would increase their taxable estate and eventually be taxed upon their death. Because the GST exemption was originally allocated to the trust, the assets could benefit Jack and Jill without any transfer tax consequences. For example, instead of the $2 million coming in into John and Jane's estate, bringing that value up to $17 million from $15 million, and then that additional $2 million being taxed at an estate rate of 35%, The assets could remain in trust and then not be taxed at the death of John and Jane, and their kids would receive 100% value of that $2 million trust. The second question to consider is whether is there any advantage to transfer the state trust situs? There are some states, specifically Wyoming, Nevada, Alaska, South Dakota, and Delaware, that have favorable trust laws. Also, many of these states have zero state income taxes. So depending on your goals of the trust and whether state laws will allow a transfer, I would say it'd be worth your effort to review your client's trust agreements. The last question here is, what types of assets should the trust hold? In the case of the Browns, they will probably not be taking distributions. This means the trust would have a long-term horizon and should invest in high-growth assets. One important factor to consider is trust income within their tax brackets. Once the taxable income in a trust hits $11,200, it's actually in the highest ordinary income tax bracket of 15%. However, qualified dividends and long-term capital gain rates are still taxed at 15%. The last piece we're going to discuss today is other income, which can include annuities, pensions, Social Security, and life insurance. We'll discuss annuities in the case study in the next slide. Pension income is actually becoming increasingly rare today, but it should be carefully reviewed and considered if the client has available. Social Security is still around at this point, but it should also be reviewed for the best age to begin to take income in. If the clients are in good health and have a family history of longevity, then it could make sense to begin at age 70 versus 66 because of the increased benefit your clients will receive. Life insurance is also another option for planning, and policies should be reviewed and considered for other types of opportunities as discussed earlier. In the case study here, I've assumed the Browns own two annuities. The annuities both have unrealized gains and have a guaranteed 5% high mark step-up. The high mark step-up is a fairly new option in annuities and allows the income stream to be based on the high point in the market the annuity was held, so a pretty powerful option to have. So a couple questions to ask your clients with annuities. First being, when is the best time for a client to annuitize? This question depends on what type of annuity the client owns. There are several new types of annuities that have come out over the last few years, and the answer to this question may be never. Some of the annuities have a rider attached that will guarantee a lifetime withdrawal rate without ever annuitizing. Typically, the rate is 5% depending on your client's age. These annuities are becoming increasingly popular and can give a client a sense of security with a guaranteed rate. Another question often asked is, what are the tax effects of annuity income? Annuity income is typically taxed as ordinary income. A lot of times, depending on the type of annuity, the distribution would be a portion of taxable ordinary income and a portion of return on principal, which is not taxable. The breakdown determined on the original would be determined on the original investment into the annuity. So you'd have to review the type of annuity and the original investment to actually determine the correct tax liability. So as you can see, your clients can have several effective advisors, each working individually on a piece of your client's financial picture. But it is important for advisors to work together as a team to develop the best retirement withdrawal plans for clients. Plan can require a lot of attention, and many pieces must be reviewed at least quarterly or annually to take advantage of certain tax benefits. Tax law changes can have a significant impact on the plan and must be updated accordingly. We actually have run short on time, so we don't have any time to take questions at this point, but if you do have a question, please feel free to email either Warren or myself, and we'll try and get back to you as quickly as we can.
Great. Thanks, Dave. I thought that was very comprehensive, and I hope this was a good use of your time. Again, our goal here is to really stress the idea that we really enjoy and working with our clients' advisors. We also think it's very, very important to getting the best answer. Like a lot of things, the best answer is generally complicated and is best tailored for individuals, and is really a combination of bringing sort of the best investment advice, best legal advice, best tax advice, best planning advice, and making sure that all of those work well together. So again, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Have a great night, everyone.